Are you ready to supercharge your music career?
You've come to the right place.
This is the Real Musicians Don't Starve podcast, the only show where you will learn firsthand how musicians just like you have turned their passions into highly successful long-term careers. I'm your host, Michael Elsner, and I'm so happy to have you with us today. Now, let's dive into this episode. Hello and welcome to Real Musicians Don't Starve. I'm Michael Elsner, and today we are here with Matt Revere. And I've been looking forward to say that for such a long time because it rhymes and it's a good rhyme. But Matt is a guitar player based out of Nashville, and he's played with a ton of artists, some of which include Carrie Underwood, the band Perry, also Scotty McCreery from American Idol fame, right? A number of other artists along the way, and I'll have him share that with us. But Matt's had a fantastic career for many years. One of the reasons why I wanted to have him on the show today was because he's been able to consistently get gigs really throughout his career. You know, as our careers move forward, one gig ends, one artist goes back in the studio for a while, and he's been able to then, you know, parlay that into another gig with someone else and stay consistently busy. So one of the reasons I really wanted to have him on was to talk about consistency and developing consistency in your music career. So Matt, thank you for coming and hanging out with me today.
Thanks for having me.
This is going to be a good time. We haven't seen each other in a while, but we were neighbors up until he moved a little further down the road. I want to start with I just want to dive right in. And you came to Nashville to go to college,
mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
And you went to Belmont, and you got I'm assuming a music degree.
I did. Yeah.
Okay. And then wasn't it through, or right after Belmont, you got your first gig? Can you maybe just explain a little of how you first got into the touring world?
Okay. So, like you said, I was at Belmont and I was studying music, but my specific degree is commercial guitar with an emphasis in music business. It's a long name that just means I've played guitar a whole lot for 4 years. So when I was getting close to graduating, there was an act on Curb Records called Bombshell. It was these two blonde-haired female country singers, and they were quite a hoot to work with. So they and their management called Belmont. They said, well, we need a young guitar player to come do this road thing, you know. And so they called Belmont. They said, who do you have? And Belmont, I really appreciate it. They put my name in on it. So that was my first road gig, and I was super duper green, and I really wish I could go back in time and tell my younger self all of the finer details of what to do, maybe what not to do when you're on a gig. But I had a good time, and they were super sweet people, and it was a good first gig to do.
That's awesome. So was that a gig that you auditioned for, or you were just recommended for it?
So auditions are kind of a funny thing in Nashville, because they could be, well, I'll tell you this audition story for Bombshell. They said, like, so can you, like, audition for us? Can you, like, play for us? And I said, yeah, sure, anytime. Just let me know when. They said, okay, can we come over to your dorm, like, this afternoon? And I'm like, yeah, is there any songs you want me to learn? And they were like, nah. So anyway, so I go to meet them at the gate to let them into the on-campus apartments, and they're just, like, giggling and laughing. And they're just being like so silly, just very, very silly people. And they came in and they were just like, well, I guess play for us. And I was like, well, what do you want to hear? They're like, I don't know, just play. And so I just played whatever. And they're like, okay, cool, you got the gig. It's really funny. That kind of runs the gamut of that could be a Nashville audition, or it could be like what you think in terms of, okay, this is an audition. Like you're standing in line in a hallway outside of a rehearsal space, and you know, you're up and you go up and there's management's there and they're video recording it so that they can play for the artist later. Like I've done those auditions too. So they really vary wildly.
Yeah, those are most of the auditions that I've run across through my career. You stand out,
oh, yeah.
You go in and everyone's just sitting there on the couch, you know, waiting for you to play and impress them. And it's awkward.
It's not a good feeling.
No, but the funny thing is that the gigs
that you usually, or at least for me, that I've always gotten, I've never auditioned for them. They were the gigs that always came through, you know, just a recommendation. And then you show up and you meet someone and, you know, you have your first little rehearsal. And if it goes well, you're in with them.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'll be the first to admit, and I've held auditions myself, auditions for the most part are just a formality to appease management.
Right.
Because, I mean, the vast majority of the time, you already know who you want to get the gig. You kind of have them picked out a little bit in your head, but you still need to go through the motions of listening to other players, you know?
Sure. You want to make sure that they know that you tried out all your options.
Exactly.
So on the line of auditions and getting the various gigs that you've had through your career, I know a lot of that has come through just networking. And that's actually what I really want to focus on today with you is, because you've been able to go from one gig into the next gig, into the next gig. And a big part of that, like with any aspect of the music industry as a whole, is networking. And I would love to get your opinion on and your take on the way that you approach networking, how you stay in contact with people, just the overall, 30,000 foot view of your approach to networking with others in the industry.
Yeah. Okay. So this is something that I tend to disagree with a lot of other players on. And I totally respect the concept of building your network as big as you can get. But in terms of like landing a gig, one friend is worth 100 acquaintances in terms of getting the gig. So those, your real relationships, that's what's going to get you the job, because what you're going to be doing is you're going to be living on a bus with people and you're going to be traveling the country, the world, or whatever. So a lot of times people will want to hire their friends, and that's kind of what it is. Now, what you can do to help your network from a business perspective is be a good musician, show up on time, all those things that I'm sure people are always saying, you know, like look the part, you know, show up knowing your parts, all those things. So basically, if you can maintain your ability to be a professional employee of an organization, then your friends will be happy to get you on their gig. And that's, in my experience, that's how I have gotten most gigs.
Yeah. So, I know you pretty well, so I know a little bit more of your story. And one of the other aspects that I know has played a big role in your career has been the fact that you've also invested heavily in your gear.
Yes, I have.
And you know, I know that you know a lot of people try and get by with the bare minimum, you know, but you from the beginning have approached this always as a business, and you've invested into your road gigs and into the racks of gear that you take, or maybe not racks of gear, but you know your full guitar.
There was a time.
Yeah. But you know that plays a big role as well. Whether you're an instrumentalist or you're a producer or an engineer, you know, having the gear and the high quality gear is a huge proponent of that success as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it has to do with image. Not necessarily the image of, oh, this guy's totally the image of just a rock star. But I mean, more so the image of this guy is a professional, okay? And buying things like road cases is about as fun as buying tires. It stinks. It's not fun. But when you show up and you've got the correct guitars for the gig, because some gigs, you know, they'll have some special thing where they're like, oh, we need a 12 string, or yeah, we need a big body jazz guitar, whatever. Just having those instruments at your disposal and you're ready to do the gig like it should be done, then, you know, the band leader or management or the artist themselves could be thinking, oh, good. Yeah, this was a good decision to hire this person, because it's obvious that they take this seriously.
Yeah. One of the things I learned when I was starting out years ago, I remember I was in a studio with an engineer, and he had, you know, he always had cartage bringing his racks of gear with him. And cartage is whenever, you know, people show up at a session, they hire basically a moving company, for those who don't know, that all their gear for them. And that costs a lot of money. Excuse me. And I remember we were working on a record, and he, you know, I worked with him for a while, and he kept bringing these racks of gear with him, but they were always sitting off in the corner. They were turned on, but he wasn't using them. I remember at one point I asked him, I said, why are you even bringing these? You know, you haven't used them in a while. And I remember he hit stop on the playback and turned around. There was no one else in the control room. And he said, the reason I bring them is because the people who hire me, they look at that and it justifies my rate. Yeah. And I thought, that makes a lot of sense. You know?
Okay, I've got a similar story. A very successful guitar player in Nashville that shall remain unnamed. He was giving me advice as I was a young tyke, and he was like, dude, if I can give you one piece of advice, if you have a session, get cartage. Bring cartage in. Even if it's going to cost you more than you'll make on the session, just get cartage. I thought that was so ridiculous. But, I mean, maybe he's onto something.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm missing something.
Well, probably not. I mean, you've done pretty well. But
well, so has he.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's definitely the element of kind of going back to, like, you know, people oftentimes they will make decisions based on what they see, you know? And it's funny, in the music space, they'll a lot of times make decisions based on what they see as opposed to what they hear, you know? And
yes,
you know, even
absolutely.
As a guitar player showing up, I remember I was showing up on some sessions with a particular custom-made guitar that I had by a company called Brian Moore Guitars. And I remember I'd have people say, like, oh, what is that? Or even actually, you know what, I'll pull that one away, McPherson. Because you're a McPherson artist as well.
Absolutely.
And I remember I showed up one time at a studio with my McPherson. This is out in Los Angeles. And I think it was like a Martin and a Gibson, you know, the standard looking acoustic guitars. Yeah. For those who don't know the McPherson, it looks a little different. And I remember the person, you know, I pulled it out and the producer was like, what's that? And I was like, oh, it's a McPherson. It sounds amazing. And he was like, yeah. So let's just do the Gibson or the Martin or whatever it was. He didn't even want to hear it. And I remember I pulled up the other, you know, guitar, I was playing it and I was in the, you know, overdub room. And at one point I pulled up the McPherson. I was like, hey, can we just listen to this quick? So, you know, I just wanted to hear it because it's such a beautiful guitar.
Yeah.
And I played it. And I remember he came over, he goes, what is that again? I was like, it's a McPherson. He's like, and he had no idea what it was, but ultimately that's what we ended up using our session because it sounded better than the other ones. But when you pull it out, it doesn't look like what people are used to seeing.
Yes.
You know? And
people tend to make the safe bet.
Yeah.
You know, like Gibson or Martin, they're like, well, that's a safe choice, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, they really should just listen a little bit more. The phenomenon that you're referring to, I call the emperor's new clothes syndrome. Uh-huh. And I mean, as a professional, it has hurt me at times and it has helped me at times. I've done some gigs where you hire some guy, it's just legendary, you know, just like so incredible. And you're like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe I'm going to be on this gig with whomever it is, right? And then you're doing the gig and I'm thinking, he didn't learn the song, you know, this, you know, I'm blessed to be in his presence doing this gig, but this dude doesn't, like, the bridge is coming up and I know he's not going to know what it is.
Yeah.
Which is, and I find that quite shocking. So in some ways, I think it might be a better choice to hire a young, talented, hungry player than the legends out there, because sometimes, and not all the time, but sometimes legends can just kind of rest on their name, you know?
I agree with you 100%. I think that there's a reason why I think some of the best records ever made were made by, you know, not session musicians. You know, they were made by guys who are hungry to really create something, you know, as opposed to the session guy who's just looking at it as another day, another, you know, 3-hour session that he's coming in to do, you know.
And of course, those records sounded different than everything else that was out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said about having the hunger. You know, one of the reasons I generally don't ever hire session musicians. I like to hire my friends who tend to be a little more hungry, you know, and they're going to put a lot more time and energy into their part. It might take more time to get it, but I think a lot of times in my experience working with other guys who do this every day, you know, 3 sessions a day, you know, they're going to fall back on what they know. But sometimes it's the people who are really hungry. They're going to come up with the great ideas and the stuff that makes it awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. I love asking other musicians this question, and that is, what is your definition of success? How do you see, you know, as musicians, when we're growing up, we always probably thought like, oh, you know, I'll be successful when I'm on MTV and, you know, when I have a number one song. But as we, you know, get older and actually start really working in the industry, those definitions change. So I'd be really curious to know what your definition of success is now at this point in your career.
Okay. So back when I was in college, I made this bucket list kind of, and I was like, okay, something I really want to do. I definitely want to play for a really big artist. And I don't know what I was thinking in terms of like, what's really big, mm-hmm. you know, because that's such a subjective and comparative sort of thing. I don't know. But in my mind, that was the goal. All right. Really big artists. Right. But I mean, I've worked for a lot of artists, and some people would consider some of those artists really big, and some people would not consider some of those artists really big. The Carrie Underwood gig is unique, and I think there's a pretty good consensus that most people would say, oh yeah, that she's really, really big, right? So in that sense, like, okay, cool. Scratch that off the bucket list. It's been awesome, right? But as I get older, I'm kind of looking at life as a whole and what I want to do with my career. And I just kind of think, well, if I can make it through life not having to get a real job, that's what I consider success.
Yeah. What is a real job?
You know, like the kind of job where you go, should I iron a pleat in my pants or no pleat? And those are the pants you wear to your real job.
Yeah.
You know, my answer with blue jeans on the stage is always no pleat every time.
Okay. You know, what's funny is I think a lot of musicians look at, you know, having the real job as just a 9-to-5, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. But
the funny thing is that when you're actually out touring and traveling and doing the real musician, you know, career, it's so much more grueling than a 9-to-5.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's extremes, you know, because I get this question a lot, like, how do you handle being on the road and having a family? Because I'm married and I have two small children. Okay. I know you know that, but perhaps viewers and listeners will not know. Okay. But my answer is always the same. You know, if you were to compare the amount of time that I get to spend with my family and compare that to someone that has a standard 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job, I probably get more face-to-face time with them than someone in a normal job would have.
Yeah.
But the difference is I could be gone for a weekend or 6 weeks at a time and not see them at all. And then I could be home for a weekend or 6 weeks at a time and see them that entire time. So I think overall, I probably get to spend more time with them.
It's so funny that you bring that up, because that was actually a situation that happened, excuse me, in my 20s, excuse me. With a good friend of mine, and I still remember this so, you know, clearly, good friend of mine was dating this girl, and she broke up with him because he was out touring a lot. I remember his argument with her. He's like, but I'm home more than anyone else would be. Exactly what you said.
Yeah.
I'm gone for 3 or 4 days, but then I'm home for 10. And if you're
uninterrupted
hours, you actually have more time with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that works.
I remember I was dating my wife. We had been dating for like 2 weeks or something. Like it was a new relationship. And I said, hey, really like you. I see this going somewhere. I am a musician, so I'm going to be probably gone a lot. I just want to make sure that you're okay with that. And her in her naive way was like, yeah, that's fine. She didn't know what she was getting into.
Well, because, you know, now, you know, with some of the tours, you're gone for, you know, what, 3-4 weeks at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then home for a short amount of time. Like this, we just did the Big Carrie tour we did last year. Like, we were gone a lot. Like, we were definitely gone much more than I typically am in a calendar year. But and the really bad thing was I left on the tour like 4 days before it was time for us to move.
Yeah.
And so I was like, sorry, sweetheart, I've hired a moving company, good luck with boxes, you know.
I remember the thing that was interesting about that is, you know, you guys were gone for a while, but most tours, especially out of Nashville, are gone for, you know, 3 or 4 days at a time, and then they come back to town.
Weekend warrior, yes.
So, yeah, and so I remember when you guys were going and you guys were out for quite a while, I thought, man, that's actually kind of a rare experience for Nashville musicians to be gone that long.
That's because that's more of an L.A.-based style of touring, because the L.A. people, you probably know this very well, they'll go for much longer periods of time, and then when the tour's over, they're looking for another gig, okay, because they have fulfilled that contract, that obligation with whatever artist hired them. But in Nashville, we do a lot of Weekend Warrior stuff, and then every once in a while you do kind of the longer stints out on the road. And when that tour is over, you're waiting for the next one. And there's going to be dates in between, and it's just a different thing that that Nashville and LA just don't really have in common in that way.
Right. Well, and one of the reasons for that is because Nashville's more centrally located. So, you know, if you're in Nashville and you have to do a bunch of gigs up to you know, Pennsylvania and New York and stuff like that, you know, that's really an overnight drive. You know, your bus driver can do that, you can pretty much be there by the time you wake up.
Yeah.
And same thing until you start getting really far out west, you know, Arizona, California, then you're going to be gone for you know, longer stints. But most tours out of Nashville will, you know, again, for the people who don't know, they'll do 3 or 4, you know, nights in a certain area, you know, little tri-state area kind of range. Mm-hmm. And then you're back to Nashville on a Sunday night or Monday, and you're back home till you have to leave on Wednesday night or Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, because you can get to those places a lot easier. In California, you can't. You know, if you're doing stuff in Georgia and Florida and whatnot, you're on the East Coast, you're going to be on the East Coast for a week or two, and then till you circle your way back to California. Yeah. So a lot of it's just location based. That's very interesting. So, you know, we've discussed a little bit of your mindset. You were very goal centered, you know, when you started. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, you've developed the skill set, and you put together, I think a lot of this comes back to the mindset. You approached it like a business. You put together, you know, the guitar rig. You knew how to show up to the gig as a professional. But what do you think has been the biggest contributor to your overall success and consistent success as a musician?
Well, it's kind of a silly answer, but I think the secret to my consistency as a musician is my consistency as a musician. Because, I mean, I've got this fear of showing up and not being prepared. So a lot of the times I'll kind of over-prepare. And in preparing, I'll write out the charts. And I'll go, well, I've written out these charts. I might as well send them to the rest of the band. Mm-hmm. I'll send out charts and then I'll make all the notes I can and try to memorize as much as I possibly can. And then when I show up, I've just got this fear of, like, everyone is going to be more prepared than you are. Mm-hmm. You're going to look dumb, you know. But that thankfully, that doesn't really happen. A lot of times what happens is I've prepared sufficiently, and I'm looking around the room, and I'm thinking, okay, this guy did a great job. This guy did a great job. This fella could have put a little more time in, but that's okay. We'll be good for the gig, you know? So I think that's important, is just consistently always being prepared.
Hey, I just want to jump in here for a second and let you know that if any of your goals over the next year include recording and releasing a new album, generating placements of your songs on TV shows and films, or just building a fan base that will sustain your music career, I want to invite you to my special workshop, Real Musicians Don't Starve. In this workshop, we are going to focus on the 3 keys to your success, and you're going to learn an extremely powerful strategy that allows you to create your own wow factor. This allows you to attract opportunities to you and your music, as well as remove any financial worry from your life. You can check out this workshop for free at realmusiciansdontstarve.com/workshop. Now back to the podcast. So I would love for you to tell the story, if you don't mind. I know that you had an audition that you over-prepared for, that you actually even learned some of the music.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I was playing with Scotty McCreary, and by the way, I loved that gig. Everyone involved in that camp is fantastic, okay? But we were on tour with the band Perry, and the band Perry's guitar player was leaving. And the band Perry was kind of known for one of the few country acts that had choreography, all right? When I say choreography, it's not like really complicated dance moves. It's just, you know, like whatever, you know, like very light choreography, okay? So when I was learning the music, learned all the guitar parts, and then I thought, you know what? I know that they're big in choreography. Why don't I just go ahead and learn all of that stuff too? And so I'm on the tour bus on the Scotty gig, and I'm like watching their like award show performances, and I'm doing this choreography as I'm lying in my bunk and I'm listening to the music. I'm going, okay, got it, you know? And so what was kind of funny is there was this one part in the song where I had to make like a patch change on my TC Electronic G system. Remember those?
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Those are fun, right? Okay, so I had to like do like a patch change, but I was doing choreography. But luckily, the choreography involved like getting down, like crouching down. And so instead of hitting it with my foot, I like crouched down and like hit it with my hand, because it worked out perfectly that the choreography and the patch change worked together. So I show up to the audition, and this is one of those where they've got a few different people showing up, and they're gonna record it and show it to the artist later. And I say, if you don't mind, I'm talking to the band leader. I'm like, can we do the choreography with it? And he's like, oh, we don't need to worry about that. And I was like, no, can we? He's like, did you learn it? And I was like, yeah. He goes, okay, boys, let's do the choreo too. And so in the audition, you know, I'm playing and I'm doing all the stuff, like just trying to make it so that on the next show, it would be a seamless transition in as many ways as possible, that their organization could continue smoothly. And thankfully I got the gig and all was well.
Wow. So, and correct me if I'm wrong, that gig initially led to you becoming the band leader too at some point, right?
Yes. Because funny enough, the band leader is a guy named Jason Fitz, an incredibly talented fiddle player. He is now an ESPN like host. So he went from touring musician to an ESPN sports host. And wow. He's as happy as he can be over there. So he's doing great. But there was a spot left open, and they were like, hey, Matt, you be the band leader. And so that was fun.
I would think that the being overprepared from the beginning plays a big role into landing that gig.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, when you're in rehearsals and everything, part of being overprepared is that you tend to have more opinions. And so at that point, the hard part becomes how do you be a productive and helpful member of the band and not annoying, you know? So, I mean, of course I've stepped in both sides, I'm sure, but it does show the artist and management that you really care about it.
Now I have two more questions. Yeah. And the first one is that, you know, no musician's career is a straight, you know, shots up to the top. You know,
yeah, definitely not.
It's always going to be, you know, the ups and downs, the busy seasons, the non-busy seasons.
Yeah.
You know, and I also, you know, I know you personally for a number of years. I know that there was a season before the Carey gig that you and your wife were looking to actually just, you know, move back to Texas and do some other things. I'm curious to know, and I know that was during a slow season.
What a nice way to put it.
Yeah, you're right. But I mean, we all have them.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I've had many times where I was like, I'm throwing in the towel, you know, and I'm going to go back to New York and figure out something else to do. But yeah. But you always overcome it, you know, because you know, it can be frustrating, like anything, any business can, you know, get frustrating. But I'm curious to know, you know, how you overcome those, I guess I'll refer to them as like maybe the dark periods. Mm-hmm. in our career. What is some of the mindsets or the strategies that you've been able to employ to get past those and then to keep ascending the ladder in your career?
Okay, so for me, if we were to graph, you know, that my career is kind of like college and, you know, different gig, and it was really good. And then I was working for the band Perry, and they fired me. I was let go, okay? And I'll never forget, we had this listening party of this album that they were going to be putting out. I'm sitting next to my friend, who's the drummer, and we're listening to all these songs. And I lean over and I go, hey, there's no guitar on this album. Because they went like way pop there at this time in their career. My buddy was like, no, that's cool. It's cool. Just don't worry about it. But I was definitely worried about it. I called my wife. I was like, sweetie, on this, because we did like a small pop-up tour. I was like, Laura, on this tour, I'm not playing guitar. I'm literally standing on the side of the stage as the band leader with a microphone, and I'm telling them what song is coming next. Oh, wow. Okay? So... And I was getting paid to do that. And I was like, this isn't going to last. And I was right. You know, they let me go. It's probably in their best interest since my forte is playing guitar, being a guitar player and all. Anyway, so at that point, I'm thinking, all right, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I just kind of said, all right, well, I'm going to rebuild the network, even though I already had a network that was going. But in my mind, it was like, okay, start over. Start from scratch, you know. And it wasn't fun. It wasn't fun to go from like national television appearances to bar gigs. And I mean, Lord knows what, you know? And so I remember sitting there and I'm thinking, I think I'm going to not be a guitar player anymore. I think I'm just going to quit. Cause you know, this is rough. You know, I'm going to stop playing. Okay. I'm done. And in my mind, it felt like I had like broken up with like a high school girlfriend.
Sure. Oh yeah.
You know, it was like, I'm breaking up with guitar. It's not you, it's me. And then it felt totally different. And some people would be like, well, what happened? You know? Well, like 3 days later I had a gig, so I did not break up with guitar anymore. That's literally what happened. I was like, oh, okay, we're gonna go play guitar. But in my mind it was over. And then that's just what happened. You know, if you were to graph my career, it kind of goes like this and then went down, and then I got a like kind of a legacy country gig and it went up, and then the carry thing just, so I'm happy to be where I'm at right now.
Well, I also know that during that time after the band Perry gig, I know that you were connecting with a lot of people.
I was saying yes to every gig I could do.
Yeah.
No matter what it was, I was like, yeah, let's do this. And which meant I was learning songs like crazy. Yeah. You know, we talked about, you know, being a musician and having a family. My wife got so sick of it because all I would do is just sit there and just try to learn songs constantly. I just couldn't keep up with the amount of material, because if you say yes to everyone, you know, you're going to be pretty swamped. But at the time, that was kind of what I needed to do.
Yeah. Well, I think right there that shows a lot, because a lot of people will get down and they fall into their depression, and then, you know, they're not going to do anything for a while, and oh, woe is me and whatnot. And, mm-hmm. and you took that situation and you just dove right in, you know, and ultimately got back out there really quickly, you know.
It was pretty quick. I was surprised at that and very thankful.
Yeah. I think that the reality is it's been that way through my career too. You know, when you have a mindset that you're going to make something happen and you are constantly taking a lot of action on it, mm-hmm. doors open rather quickly.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that people who are like, oh, nothing's happened for 7 years. And I think, well, you haven't really been taking much action then, because mm-hmm. it doesn't take 7 years if you're constantly taking action. And kind of like what you said, you're saying yes to a lot of things that are coming your way. And you're burning the candle at both ends. You can't, yeah. you can't do that for 2 or 3 years, but, yeah. but when you start getting out there and you apply all the other things that you've learned, again, you know, you're showing up on time. You are the consummate professional. You have the gear. You know, all those things stack up, and then very quickly, you know, you're going to ascend to that next level, like that legacy country gig, and then mm-hmm. you know, have that for a little while, and then that's going to lead you to that next gig, and ultimately that next one was the carry gig. So mm-hmm. by having multiple strategies already in place, you know, you can't not fail.
Yeah, and I would say it's very similar to like if you were to have started a business and then, you know, that. For whatever reason that business fails, you know, you've got it in your head, like, I know how to do this. I've been there once before, I can do this again.
Yeah.
And so as a musician, that mentality is going to pop up often, you know, because like you said, there's going to be down times and good times. So you just got to keep saying, I've done this before, I can do this again.
I think you see that with a lot of successful entrepreneurs who've made millions of dollars and then they lose it. And then years later, they've made millions of dollars back. Well, they've learned the strategy. They just got to, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got one more question. I really appreciate it. This has been such great information. My last question is kind of goes back to the first answer that you gave. You were talking about how with your first experience with that country group Bombshell.
Bombshell.
You were saying how if you could go back and have a conversation with yourself, you know, and tell yourself all the things to do and not do, you know, from that first tour. If you could sit across the table from yourself now, if you could go back in time and have that conversation with yourself, what are two things that you would advise to do differently?
One thing, don't spend any money on shirts that have like fleur de leaves on the back. Because for a while, like that was like super cool. And I had like all those in my closet. And then I kind of looked around and said, wait a minute, these things are stupid. No one wears this anymore. And so I had to throw away like half my wardrobe. It was ridiculous. and like a totally real answer, don't debate people on the bus. Because as much as it's like, yeah, we're all friends here. You know, everyone's different. Everyone has their own opinions on things. The truth of the matter is if you're going to have a debate on politics, religion, I don't know, whatever topic you want to have, the two people that are discussing something are not going to walk away and be like, you know what? I like them more, because it's a disagreement. A debate is you're shedding light on a disagreement, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that like, it hasn't really been a big hurt on my career, but I kind of look back on that and go, you know what? Things would be a little smoother, a little more joyful if I just avoided that completely.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish people would avoid that on social media. it's made it just this you know, cesspool of hate.
Oh, it's wild. You know? Yeah, I always say posting something political on Facebook is the best way to alienate half the people you know.
Yeah, exactly. No matter where you stand, because it doesn't move anything forward in a positive way.
It does not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in the same way that it doesn't do anything positive for you on Facebook, it doesn't do anything for you on a tour bus. Now, I'm not saying don't do that with your close friends, but when you're on the bus, it's sometimes easy to forget that it is a professional setting.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't do that in a professional setting.
Yeah. I think there are definitely certain topics that should always be off the table in professional settings and religion and politics for them until, you know. Yeah. Till you make good friends and you can respectfully, you know, and I know you and I both probably have friends who we disagree with.
Of course, but that's okay.
But what's amazing is, yeah, I have a couple of friends like that and it's not a topic that comes up a lot, but it kind of becomes a joke, you know, after a while. I love these guys. They're amazing. But, you know, we don't agree. And so it comes up quickly in the conversation. Well, we don't agree, so let's not even talk about it. You
know? That's well, wise.
You're not going to convince anyone else of anything. And the same thing with when you're in a studio, you know, I think over the years of doing a lot of studio work, I've seen a lot of like people come in at a young age into the studio world and they leave also very quickly because they just don't realize that there are some topics that just don't need to be brought into the workplace.
Yeah.
I think that's a fantastic piece of advice to share.
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, I wasn't. But actually, I love it because I think it's very valid. You know, I mean, there's no reason to share, you know, there's just certain topics that don't need to be on the table all the time. Because it doesn't, again, like I said, it doesn't benefit the conversation. It doesn't move it forward. And kind of like what you said, you're not going to walk away from that conversation going, man, I like that person more.
You know, it
can be contentious, and the reality is that, especially if you're traveling and working together, you know, it's those things just don't need to be discussed. I love it. Fantastic, cool, man. You have been it's always been inspiring knowing you and seeing your career.
Oh man,
but But I think you shared a lot of great information. You know, we did talk about like the mindset. You definitely have that success driven mindset. There are three keys to success that we always, you know, talk about here with Real Musicians Don't Starve. And so, you know, it's the mindset, you know, that played a big role in the first, you know, ascension up the ladder. And then of course the second ascension up the ladder, right. The skill set, you know, you have that. And you said that too. And one of the reasons why you've been able to, your biggest, what you say, you said your biggest contributor to your success was that you've been able to, you know, what you say constantly, gosh, I forgot what you said. It was your skill set. That's why I said your
skill set. It was consistency.
Consistency.
My consistency as in a professional music career is my consistency as a musician.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, that's so important, you know, so there's your skill set and then all the actions that you've taken. So, I mean, everything that's led you to where, you know, you're at really hit on the three points that we talk about with Real Musicians Don't Starve. And one of the things that I always like to end each of these podcasts with is our manifesto. And that is that real musicians are business owners and our business is music. The business is simply an organization where value is provided in order to make a profit. And unlike starving musicians who operate with a mindset of scarcity and fear, as success-driven musicians, we operate with a mindset of abundance, confidence, and service. We are doers, we are dreamers, we are creators, and we are achievers. We know that our true value is determined by how many people we serve and how well we serve them, because our truth is real musicians don't starve.
That was awesome.
Awesome. Matt, thanks so much for joining us, and we will see everyone else in the next episode.